Accession number 19953, real one.
On the 24th of April 1915, I was on the troop ship Alaunia, anchored off the island of Tenedos, which is about 19 miles from the Gallipoli Peninsula. I was a young second lieutenant, commanding number 13 platoon Z Company, 2nd Battalion the Hampshire Regiment, 29th Division, who in August 1914 was still a pupil at Felsted School. Leaving an OTC camp at Rugeley on the eve of the declaration of war and being commissioned on the 15th of August 1914. As evening approached, we had orders to leave the Alaunia and to go aboard the SS River Clyde, a collier having been stripped of everything but metal and holes having been cut in each side of the four holds. The plan was that she should represent a second horse of Troy, and that the 2,000 troops packed inside should leave through the holes, run along gangways slung each side, and reach the shore of V Beach, running over a chain of barges connecting the River Clyde to the shore. It was appropriate that this action should take place within the sight of the plains of Troy. As soon as dusk fell, we left Tenedos. The night was dark and very silent. The sea, which up to a few hours before had been rough, was now very smooth. The night was bitterly cold. The holds were crowded and uncomfortable. Some of the officers went up onto the deck. I tried to get some sleep, but the cold and hard iron decks were not congenial to rest. I did find a warm sheltered spot near the engines, but as I was dozing off, a heavy sea boot was planted firmly on my face. I had overlooked the fact that I was lying across the doorway to the engine room. Later, we were all ordered below. As dawn approached, we were ordered to brace ourselves firmly to take the shock of impact with the shore. As a matter of fact, the impact was so slight that we hardly felt it. For a short space, there was dead silence. A strong current made the positioning of the barges connecting with the shore a difficult and dangerous job. The Turks held their fire till the foremost of the troops reached the shore. Then hell itself was let loose. We in the holds could see nothing, but the row of bullets hitting the River Clyde was deafening. The beach is a small U-shaped cove. On the west side are tallish cliffs. On the east side stands the Fort Sed El Bahr, behind which, on the top of the cliffs, stands a village. In the center, the ground sloped down to the sand of the narrow beach. During the night of the 24th, a French division landed on the Adriatic shore between Berserker Bay and the entrance to the Dardanelles, with the object of capturing Fort Cum Carle, which overlooked V Beach. The concentrated fire on the River Clyde continued for a considerable time, slowly dying down, but resumed each time fresh troops tried to reach the shore. We were also subjected to quite heavy fire from Fort Cum Carle, which was not captured till mid-morning. Shells were falling all round us, and we suffered three direct hits. Luckily, none came into number 3 hold where I was, but in the next hold, a shell exploded, killing 2 men and wounding many. It became obvious that it would be murder to send more troops ashore for the moment. During this lull in the proceedings, I, with a few others, went up to the after deck, where the superstructure completely sheltered us from the enemy fire. From there, we had a grand view of the mainland and could watch the French advance towards and capture Fort Kumkale. We could also watch Commander Sansom dropping coloured lights to direct the guns of the Queen Elizabeth. During this period, she sank a Turkish troop ship in the Narrows. As there was nothing immediate for me to do, I obtained some hot water from the engine room to make a hot drink, for we had had no food since boarding the River Clyde. The drink was not nice, tasted oily, and I threw most of it away. But I did obtain a second mug of hot water and shaved myself. The last shave I was to have for 7 days. During this lull, General Napier was ordered to the shore to find out why the landing was held up. As he came alongside the River Clyde, the senior officers on board shouted that it was impossible to land at that moment, and urging him to come on board. He yelled back, "I have been ordered ashore, and I will have a damn good try." As he stepped ashore, he received about 30 bullets in the chest, and his staff captain the same number. Soon after this, Colonel Carrington Smith and his adjutant were both killed on the bridge of the River Clyde, and my company commander, Major Beckwith, took charge of the landing operations. It was entirely owing to him that the landing on this beach was accomplished. He received the DSO for his work, and afterwards became a brigadier. Later on in the day, I presumed at a moment when the enemy were reorganizing themselves, for they too must have sustained considerable loss, both from the machine guns placed on the bows of the River Clyde to cover the landing, and from the shells continually pumped inland by the fleet. More troops were ordered ashore, and I then led my platoon out of the River Clyde onto the gangway on the starboard side, and the sight that met our eyes was indescribable. The barges, now linked together and more or less reaching the shore, were piled high with mutilated bodies, and between the last barge and the sand was a pier formed by piles of dead men. It was impossible to reach land without treading on the dead, and as Commander Sansom had reported, the sea round the cove was red with blood. Eventually, No. 13 platoon reached the cover of the cliffs and there formed up and awaited instructions. Shortly before dusk fell, I was ordered to advance through the barbed wire entanglements on the west side of Fort Sed El Bahr and take up a position in the open to protect the beach from an attack made during the night. Again the night was dark and very cold. My platoon were lying in the open in extended order. At intervals throughout the night, searchlights flashed hither and thither, searching for us. For the Turks knew we were there, but not quite were. Also throughout the night, machine guns were searching for us. On one occasion, they got our range, and a bullet spat into the sand, nicely placed, one between each man. Once when raising myself on my elbow, a bullet struck the sand just beneath my chest. None of us had had much sleep since the Friday night, and fearful that the men might fall asleep, I kept a fairly continuous stream of messages passing up and down the line. Shortly before dawn, I received orders to retire to the beach, where Major Beckwith, with the help of the regimental sergeant major, reformed all the troops. Shortly after daylight, an assault was made on Fort Sed El Bahr. The fort was very much of a ruin, but we came under very heavy pom-pom fire, the shells being lobbed over from the village. At about this time, too, a message was received from the fleet to say that HMS Queen Elizabeth was about to fire shrapnel from her 14-inch guns for the first time, and troops were to look out as they might fall short. Personally, I wondered what exactly we were supposed to do if they did. But in any case, we seemed to be somewhat fully occupied with other things. When we had gained possession of the fort, the object was to capture the village, which looked like being a slow job. Here Major Beckwith ordered Lieutenant Parker and myself to try to climb along the cliff on the east side of the village and force an entry about halfway along. The rock cliff was high and almost perpendicular. Below was the sea, and on the rocks at the foot of the cliff more than one mangled body lay. It must be remembered that we carried very heavy equipment, a full pack which also contained a spare pair of boots, extra water, I think 3 days' supply, and in addition 200 extra rounds of ammunition in bandoliers slung round the neck. Officers carried exactly the same amount as the men, except that they carried a revolver instead of a rifle, but they too carried the extra water and rifle ammunition. This encumbrance made the climb even more difficult and perilous. One was covered from direct rifle fire, but at one point a large boulder, evidently pushed over by the enemy, came bounding down the cliff straight for me. I thought I was about to be added to the mangled remains below, but the boulder bounced just above my head and again below my feet, and I was still safe. Eventually we re-entered the village and joined up with other troops of the Hampshire Regiment. The village consisted of one straight main street with ruined houses on each side. Slowly we worked our way through the village, but with bullets whizzing down the street, crossing it as something of a hazard. However, when necessary, we did this one by one, somewhat after the fashion of children, daring each other to be the last to cross a road in front of a motor car. On one occasion, one of the men had a nick taken out of his nose. Poor man. But somehow, I remember, we all thought this rather a joke. When we got to the last house in the village, Major Beckwith decided that our next objective was a redoubt, situated on a small hill beyond the village. To capture this would secure the position and consolidate the beachhead on V Beach till contact was made with troops who landed on the other beaches. At this stage, Major Beckwith detailed two men to accompany me and ordered me forward to reconnoitre. It was while on this mission that I was wounded. I was helped back to the cover of the last house in the village. Shortly after this, I heard the cheers of the troops as they charged and took the redoubt. Later, Major Beckwith came back, dressed my wound, and sent me down to the beach. From there, I was taken out to the Caledonia. at about 6 p.m., in a very weak and exhausted condition, having had no sleep since the previous Friday and no food since the Saturday tea time. On Tuesday evening, the 27th, I was sent from the Caledonia to the hospital ship Delta, and on the Thursday night we sailed for Egypt. The cot next to me was occupied by Lieutenant Parker, who died from wounds on the journey to Egypt. On Sunday the 2nd of May, 1 week after the landing, we arrived at Alexandria, and I was sent to the Anglo-American Hospital in Cairo. I was sent back to Alexandria and taken to the hospital about Glengorn Castle on the 19th of May. We arrived at Southampton late on the evening of the 31st of May, but I was not sent ashore till the 1st of June. 50 years have passed since these events occurred, but with the exception of a private talk with my father and mother and a recent unrehearsed talk for the BBC, my story has never before been told. Even now, some things remain untold, things which no words can describe, things which one would rather not remember, but nevertheless things which are engraved upon the mind forever. It is interesting to know that the River Clyde is still in service. In 1919, she was towed to Malta. She was sold to the Spanish and renamed Angela. In 1929, she was again sold to her present owners, Gamma Sidon Uniquera, and renamed Maruya e Aurora.